Welcome to The Inquiry on the BBC World Service with me, Tanya Beckett. One question, four expert witnesses, and an answer. This spring, India endured the most dramatic heat wave since records began over 100 years ago.
We are in Delhi, in the middle of a severe heat wave that has gripped the city and many other parts of the country.
Days of flooding and landslides in parts of Bangladesh and eastern India have affected millions of people.
Forecasters are predicting that a month and a half long heat wave that has been punishing India is about to end.
In May, temperatures hit 47 degrees centigrade. The heat wave is estimated to have led to at least 90 deaths across India and Pakistan, and has also led to, amongst other things, forest fires and damage to the wheat crop. The extreme temperatures are being blamed on global warming. India's government wants richer countries to help it prepare for adverse weather events by building early warning systems and help fund reconstruction after damage to infrastructure, homes and crops. So this week on The Inquiry, we're asking, is India becoming too hot to live in?
Part 1. Monsoons and cyclones.
South Asia lies to the north of the equator and is surrounded by three vast bodies of water: the Bay of Bengal, the Indian Ocean, and the Arabian Sea.
If you look on a globe or a map, you can see it's covered on all sides by the tropical waters, on all the three sides.
To India's north lies Asia's largest mountain range. The Himalayas stretch nearly 2,500 kilometres across five countries, and there are dozens of peaks over 7,000 metres. And it's these two towering aspects of India's geography, water and mountains, that help dictate its climate.
I am Roxy Matthew Cole, climate scientist at the Indian Institute of Tropical Meteorology in Pune.
During India's winter, temperatures hover around a manageable 20 degrees centigrade. But as the sun moves north, the months of March, April and May become fiercely hot, and temperatures soar to 40 degrees Celsius or even higher.
In some regions where when we experience the heat, it's not just about the high temperatures, but also the accompanying humidity as well. Some regions are dry, like northwest Indian region. But like central India and South India, there is humidity as well. And if the air has high levels of humidity along with the heat, the body can stop sweating and becomes unable to regulate the internal temperature. And this can result in heat stroke, leading to multiple organ failures and deaths. That's how oppressive the heat can be.
As the surrounding oceans heat up throughout these hotter months, warm air moves across India's landmass and carries moisture north. Then, once it reaches the Himalayas, it's trapped, and by the end of May, the season is set to change.
So during the northern summer, that is June to September, we have the summer monsoon winds carrying the moisture from the Indian Ocean and dumping us rains over the Indian region. This provides about 80% of the annual rainfall for South Asia.
The water floods the streets and drenches the children who are returning to school for the start of a new term. Nonetheless, it's met with widespread relief.
We eagerly wait for the summer monsoon rains to arrive in early June. So as the monsoon arrives with all the rains over the subcontinent of South Asia, the farmers start sowing their seeds for cultivating for the upcoming season. That's how we welcome the monsoons to the subcontinent.
By the end of August, the monsoon clouds are already in retreat, and in the final days of November, they've left the country completely. The months that follow are cooler and much, much drier.
Winter comes during October, November, this is the period when the winds reverse from land to the ocean. And during this season, we do get some rains over South Asia, but maybe around 10% of the annual rains. So these two seasons define the monsoon of South Asian continent.
But whilst the cool of the winter months makes life more manageable, the change of season brings with it a fresh threat.
Nothing stands a chance against the might of this storm. It's plundered its way through the Indian state of West Bengal, neighbouring Bangladesh also in its path.
The warming of the oceans near the equator early in the year leads to the formation of cyclones. Months later, these hit land, with the primary peak in November, then again in May, battering communities along India's 7,500-kilometre coastline.
And one of the prominent regions where we have the cyclones historically has been the Bay of Bengal in the North Indian Ocean. And if you look at the total number of cyclones across the globe, only 6% of cyclones come from this northern Indian Ocean region, but 80% of the fatalities have been from this region. So this region is not facing extreme weather events for the first time.
India's challenging climate makes life hard for the country's many citizens who earn their living from working outside. And the vast majority of Indians who work inside but with no access to air conditioning. Now climate change is making their battle to survive even harder.
The water, the warm waters of the Indian Ocean, it's warming at a fast rate. It's the fastest warming ocean compared to the Atlantic and the Pacific. And the Himalayas, the glaciers there are melting at a rapid rate. And this is putting tremendous pressure on the densely populated region, which in most of these places, we do not have early warning systems in place. And this is one of the reasons why climate change is a pressing issue for this region.
To understand how much India is struggling with high temperatures, it would help to have a look at what lengths its citizens are going to try to cope.
Part 2, the impact of climate change.
As a tropical country, India always has had heat waves. So this is something that the region is familiar with. What is climate change is doing is just making it much more intense.
Our second expert witness is Dr. Aditi Mukherjee.
I'm a principal researcher at the International Water Management Institute, based out of our New Delhi office.
Aditi explains that the first noticeable difference in India's climate in recent years is that bouts of very high temperatures have become more sustained and spread over much more of the country.
The heat waves are much more extensive in area. For instance, heat waves would be generally limited to one or few pockets, small geographical areas. But this time we have a heat wave in the region that stretches all the way from northern Pakistan all the way through India to Bangladesh. So it's an entire region-wise heat wave.
The other noticeable change is the pattern of rainfall.
So we will see more rain, but we will also see shorter periods of more intense rain followed by a longer period of more dryness. But overall, we know that warming climate has intensified this entire water cycle, causing more these intense periods of droughts and floods.
India is the world's second largest producer of wheat, and it consumes the vast majority of what it produces. This year, in some parts of the country, the crop has shrunk by a third.
That's because those temperatures were higher than what the wheat plant can actually endure. So basically, before the wheat plant could flower, the flower simply withered away and there was no wheat in the kernel. So that's been a devastating effect. And India has very recently announced that it will not export wheat because of domestic concerns, domestic food security.
Even more alarming are reports of a substantial increase in heat-related deaths and a huge impact on earnings.
So there have been a whole lot of, livelihoods income, like people, some of those not being able to work during the height of afternoon. I was in working in villages just like a couple of days ago. And yeah, I can, it's just like the heat is quite unbearable for a human body. And it's been very hard for those professions who have to work in the field during the daytime.
Schools have also been forced to close during the heat wave. But even when they're open, high temperatures stop some pupils getting to school.
Often women and young girls are tasked with the job of collecting water. So when you have water sources drying up due to high heat, or you have the task because you're not getting a piped water connection, you have to walk and get water in this heat, then that also affects women and children's health tremendously, takes them off school, affects their education. So there are these complex webs of impact.
In short, Aditi says it is the most vulnerable people who are most exposed.
So for these heat waves, for example, the ones who were more affected were the people who were already leading a very precarious existence. People have to work like agricultural laborers. So they have to work in the heat of the sun, and they do not have adequate health facilities, proper houses where they can, you know, get some cooling impact. The other people who have felt the impacts are also in the urban places, small traders who have to ply their trade on the roads in the full heat of the sun. So they have had to cope by closing their businesses early. They would just work for 2 hours in the morning and, you know, few hours in the evening. So they have had a huge loss of livelihood. Some of the poor areas in the cities, like the slums, have been affected the most through water services disruption, etc.
Part 3. Mitigation.
I'm Channi Singh, and I work as a senior researcher at the Indian Institute for Human Settlements in Bangalore.
Our third expert witness explains how the Indian government communicates with citizens when extreme weather conditions are forecast and advises on how they can protect themselves.
Sending out early warnings to people to say that there's heat coming up in the next few days or next few weeks. Then there are, of course, emergency measures, like when during a heat wave, sending out messages on how to stay cool, how to stay indoors. You should drink a lot of fluids, of course, water, keep cool, try to stay indoors between the most hot times of the day, which is around 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Also, if you are seeing any kinds of symptoms of heat stress, then to immediately go to a hospital or visit a doctor and try to get that kind of first aid.
There's also a range of other strategies that people are using.
Putting water on the floors of your house, covering your head when you're going outdoors or using an umbrella, drinking a range of cooling drinks. And there are like things that we make from seasonal fruits. And these are really indigenous practices that have been honed over generations. So I think they hold us in good stead in that way. But of course, as we know, they can only go so far.
And there is also a shift towards constructing buildings such that air moves more freely through them.
Make sure that they have better ventilation and they can keep cool even without active cooling such as air conditioners. The second thing is more nature-based solutions or ecosystem-based adaptation, which is that you designate spaces in the city where there's greenery so it can provide cooling benefits. You make sure that if trees are being cut for other development work, you actually afforest in other areas. So there are a range of nature-based solutions.
The difficulty, says Chandni, is that these measures often mainly benefit societies most privileged.
They're unequally reached or accessible to different groups of people. So urban parks typically are in wealthier parts of cities. So there's also an angle of understanding that when we put in certain adaptation strategies in place, they should be accessible to the people who are most vulnerable. And that's another area that I think we aren't thinking of enough as we are adapting to heat.
And there's another way in which poorer people are more exposed to suffering. Those with jobs in offices are more likely to benefit from air conditioning. But people who spend the day outside simply have to stop work when it's too hot.
The state of Kerala, for example, has a labor code that says that people should not be working in the afternoon, which is the hottest time, so shouldn't be working outdoors. While these kinds of strategies are helpful, maybe some safety nets also have to be provided, where maybe when people are working on a construction site, there are shaded spaces for them to cool down, provisions of water, things like that, that might help rather than telling people to not work at all.
But all of these strategies can anyway only go so far in mitigating the effects of climate change. There's a limit beyond which people simply cannot adapt to more extreme temperatures.
The question folks keep asking me is about what's the government doing? What can it do? There is only so much that a government can do when it becomes so hot. And that's why we need to talk about mitigation rather than adaptation. We can't be expecting a national government to endlessly adapt to this kind of horrific heat.
India cannot, of course, however hard it tries, stop climate change on its own. The problem is global, and it takes all countries of the world to tackle it. But as one of the nations suffering most, it does have a very strong incentive to lead the way. So what measures is it able to take to reduce its carbon footprint? Time for our final expert witness.
Part 4, cutting the carbon.
My name is Navroz Dubash. I'm a professor at the Center for Policy Research in New Delhi.
India's attempts to reduce its carbon emissions are hampered for a number of reasons. The first is that the population already suffers from not having enough access to energy. So far from being able to think about reducing the amount of power it uses, it actually needs to increase it.
A lot of people don't have clean cooking fuels. They have interrupted power supply. They don't have reliable supply for industry. So we're dealing with 20th century problems, even while we're trying to pivot to the 21st century. So you don't want to make this change in a way that further hampers the ability of India to develop and the ability of Indians to have decent livelihoods and decent lives. So the risk that the lights will go off, that there'll be instability in the system, is something that we worry about a fair bit.
Four-fifths of India's energy is produced by burning fossil fuels. The power industry is not only a large employer in its own right, but it's also a vital support for other businesses.
So, for example, the Indian rail system depends very heavily for its financial viability on transporting coal. If you take away that coal transport, then the ability of the railways to move the hundreds of millions of migrants that travel up and down India every year, the cost of moving those migrants would go up, right? And that has political implications. So the fossil fuel economy is actually woven into the economic and social fabric of a country like India, and making those changes can be quite disruptive.
Then there is the potential for a switch to power-saving buildings and clean energy. But here again, this costs money, and there are many other aspects of India's society which suffer from a chronic lack of funding.
If you're going to build green buildings, they often have higher upfront capital costs. If you're going to build charging stations for electric vehicles, that's a whole bunch of new infrastructure. And you're doing this at a time when your basic infrastructure, roads, railway lines, buildings, ports, is not very well built. And this is in a context where in most developing countries, including India, capital is more scarce and therefore more costly. In other words, you could be using that capital for a lot of other immediate development needs. So why would you choose to use it for a low carbon future if you're not confident you'll see the benefits right away? So this is the reason why this pivot is not necessarily that straightforward.
And here we come to the real difficulty. Although India's economy is growing, it desperately needs to create many more jobs to help the tens of millions of people languishing in poverty. And this is currently the overriding priority.
So if you're a poor country, if you think that reducing emissions is going to actually make you poorer, you really won't do it. You would rather focus on doing what the West has done, which is make it easier for them to keep their populations, to keep life going in their cities and to keep their populations in a mode where they can actually survive the impacts of climate change.
Unsurprising then that when it comes to the international dialogue about carbon emissions, India takes the view that the primary responsibility lies elsewhere.
Now, this is why global action has been so hard, because richer countries have said, look, even if we reduce our emissions in the future, you guys are going to grow, so we can't go it alone. And poorer countries say, yes, fair enough, but why don't you please give us a down payment? Show us that it can be done. You have emitted most of the emissions that are up there, So why don't you start the process off by reducing emissions? And this conversation, in a sense, has led to somewhat of a stalemate.
But as countries struggle to find answers, technology at least moves on.
We are beginning to see some glimmers of optimism. And this is because the cost of renewable energy has come down so much in the last decade. Actually, solar panels have got 80% cheaper. Battery storage, which is an essential component to complement solar energy, because the sun doesn't always shine, so you need to store the energy for parts of the day. That has also got 80% cheaper. Wind energy has got 50% cheaper. So suddenly we find, as of the last half decade or so, that renewable energy is actually, in some parts of the world, cheaper than fossil fuel energy. So now you can develop and have, on the back of relatively cheap energy, and contribute to climate mitigation. So we're in a sort of a more hopeful place for this reason than we have been for a while.
But this is all for the future. And as we know, India has a problem with its climate right now. So let's allow ourselves to return to our question. Is India becoming too hot to live in? The country's geography means that it's always been exposed to extreme heat and rainfall. But this has been made much worse by climate change. Temperatures are creeping higher, and sometimes that means people in India not only struggle to work, but even survive. India has many strategies to cope with heat, but as extreme temperatures become more frequent, they're not enough to protect the population from damage to its health and loss of livelihood. Heat waves mean that there's a lack of early rainfall, which reduces the yield of crops. The problem is not unique to India. Billions of people in the world are at risk because of rising temperatures, and the burden of dealing with the crisis lies not with individual countries, but the global community. Let's give the final word to our first expert witness, who reminds us of how urgent the problem has become.
This year, the heat wave has been huge. Maybe catastrophic. I do not have words to explain the heat wave this year. And this was not a heat wave over a single day or a week or a month. We experienced this heat wave from March to April and May. And even in June, we are having a heat wave. This is unexpected. This is unprecedented. And this is huge.
This inquiry was presented by me, Tanya Beckett, and produced by Louise Clark-Robotham.